Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Complementary and Alternative Medicine for MS teleconference. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question-and-answer sessions. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Outreach and Education for the National MS Society, Greater Northwest Chapter. Piper, you may now begin.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny, and I'd like to thank everybody for joining us on our monthly teleconference this evening. It's really wonderful to have you all on the line with us. We're joined today by one of the leading experts in the field of complementary and alternative medicine, Dr. Alan Bowling. Dr. Bowling is Director of the Complementary and Alternative Medicine Service and Medical Director of the Multiple Sclerosis Service at the Colorado Neurological Institute. He is also the Clinical Associate Professor of Neurology at the University of Colorado. Following the teleconference, you will receive a program evaluation, which we urge you to complete, as your feedback and ideas will help us improve our programs to provide you with the most pertinent and helpful information and support. And finally, we encourage you to consider registering for future monthly teleconferences, which are always held on the first Thursday of every month from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific time, with alternating topics and speakers. Visit us online at msnorthwest.org or call 1-800-344-4867 to find out about our upcoming monthly teleconferences. And on that note, I thank you again for being on the call this evening and pass the floor to Dr. Bowling.
Well, great. Thanks for the nice introduction. Pleasure to be here and doing this program. And I do all kinds of education-type programs, and this particular topic, specifically as it relates to MS, is my sort of favorite topic to cover because I think often it's hard to find good information and there's some exciting new information coming out. So pleasure to be here and pleasure to share what I know and share some resources that people can go to for more information. Now, before we talk about specific topics, I thought I would just define some of the terms that we'll be using tonight. So the term I think a lot of people have heard about in this area is alternative medicine, and that term actually is usually used incorrectly. The more appropriate terms are conventional medicine and unconventional medicine. Conventional medicine is what's typically available in hospitals or taught in medical schools. Unconventional medicine is what is not typically available in hospitals or taught in medical schools. So unconventional medicine are things like diets and dietary supplements and acupuncture. The term alternative medicine, that actually refers to how unconventional medicine is used. And alternative means someone uses unconventional medicine instead of conventional medicine. And that's actually not practiced by very many people in our country. It's probably just a few percent of people in our country practice true alternative medicine, you know, maybe 5% of people. The other way people can use unconventional medicine is alongside conventional medicine. That's called complementary use of these unconventional practices. And that's actually practiced quite commonly in our country and other countries. In people with MS, it's in studies in North America, Europe, Australia, they've all indicated that it's about a half to two-thirds of people with MS use some kind of unconventional medicine alongside conventional medicine. So it's actually appears to be the majority of people with MS are really trying to blend conventional medicine with unconventional medicine. And often there's limited information or sort of incorrect or dangerous information on how to do this, what's called an integrative approach. So that's what I'd like to share tonight, some thoughts on how to do this in a wise, thoughtful way. So we're going to cover three specific topics, and sometimes doing teleconferences, I think the speakers and the audience sometimes feel sort of lost in cyberspace and your brain starts wandering to unusual things. So we thought we'd break this up and do three 10-minute segments, where I'm going to talk for 10 minutes, and then we'll have a question-answer, 5 minutes of question-answer between each 10-minute segment. So we're going to start out with two of what I think are sort of currently the quintessential complementary and alternative medicine topics now in MS. So the first one's going to be vitamin D, and the second one's going to be marijuana. And then finally, we're going to talk about some ancient medicine. So we'll talk about traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and kind of what we can learn from those sort of ancient healing methods. So first of all, when we talked about doing this teleconference, I knew it was going to be happening up in the Northwest. So what topic could be any better than vitamin D to cover? So certainly as you get farther north, there's less direct sunlight exposure. Also, I've heard that you have a few cloudy and rainy days up there, so certainly that can contribute as well. This topic is really rapidly changing, and it's really something that if you have an interest, I'd encourage you to get regular updates from your physician or kind of read up, because it really is changing every few months. And the most recent review on the subject that made it into the media was the big Institute of Medicine report. So this was a panel sanctioned by commissioned by the U.S. and Canadian government to review all of the studies on vitamin D. And then this particular panel is in charge of setting the recommended daily amounts and recommendations for example, fortifying food. So big implications. So this 1,000-page report just came out about a month ago. So I'm going to incorporate what was mentioned in that report along with lots of other information. So in terms of this area, I've done some talks up in the Pacific Northwest. I have done talks in other parts of the country. I think you're part of the country among lay people and also among professionals. I think you're probably the most savvy and well-educated in this area. So I'll talk at a basic level, but I'll also talk in some pretty fine detail. So just in terms of the general approach in this area, the crux of this story basically is that two assumptions we've had about vitamin D may be incorrect. So one assumption we had is we fortify our foods, therefore most Americans must have adequate vitamin D levels. There are many studies that challenge that and question whether maybe the majority of Americans actually have vitamin D levels that are too low. So that's one assumption that may be incorrect. The other is that we've thought for many years that vitamin D really is only involved in bone health. And starting about 10 years ago, there have been many studies suggesting that vitamin D may be involved in many other processes, including processes involving the nervous system, the muscles, the immune system. So the big potential public health issue here is that many Americans may have too low a level of a nutrient that has effects on many different body systems, not just the bones. So that's kind of the crux of the concern in this area. And like I say, it's still evolving. The significance of the findings is still kind of being worked out. And how to deal with this in the moment, I think, is something that really needs to be reassessed regularly. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to try to sift through what I think the truth is and with what we know and what we don't know. And there also have been some concerns about if you push the vitamin D supplementation too much or calcium supplements too much, could there actually be harms to doing that? So I just want to let people know that in about 5 minutes we're going to do a question answer. So if you have questions building in your head, you can make a note of those, but I'm going to keep talking for 5 minutes. I think you'll hear some directions on how to do the questions. I guess the information on how to do that will be done in 5 minutes when I finish the next segment here. So in terms of how common low vitamin D levels are, it really depends on the study, when it was done, where it was done, who the population was. So you really end up with some quite different numbers. Also, there's some controversy as to how we define deficiency or insufficiency of vitamin D. Based on the numbers that we currently use, there certainly are many studies you can find where 40 to even 100, up to 100% of people who are tested have vitamin D levels that are below the what's typically thought of as the normal range. Now, what can low vitamin D do to the body, and what can correcting it do in terms of benefits to the body? That's a controversial area. One thing that we know for sure, and this is not controversial, I think everyone agrees with this, that low vitamin D is definitely not good for bone health. So that can lead to decreased bone density, things like osteopenia, osteoporosis. So that's all quite clear. And if someone has low vitamin D and low bone density, correcting the low vitamin D can help maintain the bone density, and also normal vitamin D can help prevent decreases in bone density. So that's very clear. There are quite strong studies supporting that. What's less clear has emerged from studies done the past 3 to 5 years where people with low vitamin D have been found to have a whole host of medical conditions that they may be at a higher risk for because of the low vitamin D. So low vitamin D has been sort of associated with the risk of developing MS, has been associated with a higher risk for MS attacks, higher risk for progression of MS. Low vitamin D has been associated with about, at this point, it's more than 20 other medical conditions, including other autoimmune diseases, falling, walking instability, leg function, various cancers, heart disease. So a very long list where there's an association, but whether the low vitamin D actually causes the medical condition has not been proven. There are studies actively being done to see if the low vitamin D is actually causing these conditions. So at this point, they're just associations, and that's the weakness in the data, and that's where some of the controversy is in this area. And then, so, but there certainly is suggestive evidence, and, you know, a lot of what we do in medical practice is not absolute science. We don't have absolutely definitive studies to support everything we do, so sometimes doing medicine or trying to take care of our own health is sort of making best guesses with the data that we have available. And some people think the data is strong enough with these associated conditions that vitamin D really should be a consideration. Now, there have been some risks that if vitamin D dosing is pushed too high or the blood levels are pushed too high, there may be some increased risk of some other conditions, such as pancreatic cancer, and that's certainly a very serious and fatal form of cancer, may increase the heart disease risk, could actually increase the risk for fractures and falls if you really push to very high doses. And then higher doses of calcium have been associated with prostate cancer risk in men, and then also heart disease risk in men as well as women. So this all comes down to, so what do we do with this information? It's certainly not a clean, tidy, obvious direction to use, in which to take this information and apply it in clinical practice. So in my view, I think there are three different approaches here. One is to do nothing and just say we don't know enough, so let's just wait and not really address this issue. The concern there is we have quite a large number of people, maybe the majority of Americans, have low levels of vitamin D, so that's kind of being missed, and it's being missed to actually correct it. That might be bad for people's bones, at least over the long term. A second approach is to just take some amount of vitamin D supplement, and that can be done just blindly. For example, take 1,000 units or take 2,000 units. The problem with that approach is some people may not need it, and some people may need more than what they just sort of blindly take. And then the most precise approach. You know, it sounds precise, but the exact way to carry it out is maybe not as precise. But basically, this more precise approach is to check a blood level of vitamin D. If it's low, then to supplement, and then to recheck the level later. The advantages to this approach are you're going to find out if you have low vitamin D, and then correcting it is at least going to be good for your bones and for people with MS. Maybe it's going to have a beneficial effect on the disease process of MS. In terms of how to do this, you can certainly find lots of popular books and internet sites suggesting very high doses for people with MS, like 5,000 units, 10,000 units. I think we do need to be cautious and really not push what might be a good idea too far. So certainly by any of the studies that are out there, the thought that a level up to about 50 is probably not going to increase risk for any of these other conditions. The toxic upper limit, like the maximum amount where we don't think there are higher risks for some of these other conditions, has recently been reset to 4,000 units. Those guidelines I just gave and not pushing beyond 4,000 units, I must say all that works quite well in Colorado, but in Washington State and in Alaska, it might be hard for some people to get levels up into the normal range using a dose less than 4,000 units. So there might need to be modifications based on where people live specifically. For more information, I will refer you to a website that I have. It's neurologycare.net, and that actually has the world's largest online database of information about unconventional medicine and MS. There's a whole section on vitamin D. It's free. You don't register. There really are no gimmicks to that at all. Also, National MS Society has some nice resources. The National MS Society magazine, Momentum, will have the next issue. Will have a whole article that I've written on vitamin D that will talk about this in more detail. And then the nationalmssociety.org website has a lot of articles as well. So I think we'll stop there and do some question and answer.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your touch-tone phone. Be aware that once your question is asked, your line will be re-muted. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. We currently have 2 questions in queue. Our first question comes from Laura. Laura, please go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, I have been on higher doses of vitamin D for a longer period of time because my levels don't get up high enough. Does that cause an excess of calcium, and would magnesium bring that down?
In terms of excessive calcium, if you're getting up to, you know, high doses of vitamin D, a simple thing to do is just when you recheck the vitamin D level to also check a calcium level. So that's a good monitor for it. We didn't have time to get into it, but there have been concerns about you know, specifically high doses of vitamin D and calcium, and there are concerns that people may be getting too much calcium. So we may be able to push the vitamin D higher than we have in the past, like I say, into thousands of units, but the calcium should probably, in terms of a supplement, should stay at 500 to 1,000. There's a very complex interaction between vitamin D and calcium, so in your own body, how all that balances out, the only way to sort it out is really through a blood test for the calcium level. And I'd say do that and not try to add another supplement with magnesium to alter that.
Our next question comes from Marcella. Marcella, please go ahead.
Thank you. I was wondering, is there any type of vitamin or drink or anything that can help assimilate the vitamin D into our body?
There are lots of natural ways to do that. So if your vitamin D is fat-soluble, it also can bind to specific proteins. And when it's in fat or when it's bound to proteins, that makes it much easier for the body to absorb vitamin D, and I think that's often forgotten. So, yeah, this is a very important question because I think sometimes people keep pushing higher and higher with the vitamin D and the blood level isn't going up, and then often it's not figured out that it might just be the way in which it's taken. So very simple ways to do this instead of, you know, taking it with a dose of fat might not be the best thing, but the dairy products, especially milk, have a protein that vitamin D binds to quite well, and that can help with the absorption.
Our next question comes from Sue. Sue, please go ahead.
You spoke about the levels of vitamin D. What is that in the, from the blood test? What is a good number to be looking for?
So the blood test is actually called 25-hydroxy vitamin D, and then the levels are the normal range is it's somewhat controversial. Most of what's out in the literature now says a level between 30 and 100 is the normal range. And certainly there's a lot of literature saying that having a level between 35 and 50 might be good, especially in places where there's a big variation between the blood level in the summer and the winter, so it gives you a little wiggle room there. There's a concern that if you get above a level of 50 or 55, maybe that's where some of these risks of vitamin D start coming in. Certainly if you get below a level of 20, that's definitely not a good thing for bones. The sort of intermediate range, you know, 30 to 50, we don't know of any clear risk there, and that could be the range where there's some additional benefit for some of these other medical conditions, you know, like MS specifically.
Our next question comes from Eileen. Eileen, please go ahead.
Hello, I'm here in the Northwest also.
Uh-huh.
And in addition to the lack of sunlight here, we also have a lack of selenium in the soil here. And
right.
I was informed recently that that might contribute to the difficulties with MS. I used to race horses, and I used to give massive doses of selenium when the horses had stiff legs and stuff, so I myself take large amounts of selenium too. So do you think that's beneficial or not?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, selenium can have antioxidant effects, and antioxidants for MS have some theoretical benefits where maybe they can actually protect nerves from injury. The concern is with antioxidants, most of them can actually activate the immune system, which in theory would be harmful for MS. So there's some studies going on now to try to clarify that, like what happens when you give people with MS high doses of antioxidants. Is that good? Is it bad? Or is it of no benefit? So I think until we have some answers, I'd be reluctant to push doses real high, so I'd make sure you don't get real high. And so certainly with selenium, I believe the sort of upper limit that you should not exceed is about 200 micrograms per day. And certainly if you kind of look at all the nutrients, vitamins, minerals, dietary approaches, I think where we have the most evidence is with vitamin D. And then another topic that we don't have time to cover tonight, but that's cutting back on saturated fat and increasing polyunsaturated fat, especially omega-3 fatty acids. So I think there's much more evidence for omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D than there is for something like selenium. So I think we should probably stop at that point and then move on to the next topic. So the next topic, like I say, is I think sort of another quintessential alternative medicine topic, so it's marijuana, and this is just, it's got some fascinating science behind it. There are some fascinating and very suggestive clinical studies. Also, it raises questions about how much the law should play in terms of how we each choose to take care of our own health. So, yes, some really fascinating issues come up in this area. I think it is interesting. A lot of certainly the early movement in terms of medical marijuana laws really happened in the West. So California was first, but then the Northwest was pretty quick to follow within a couple years. So I think it was 1998 that the medical marijuana laws were passed in Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. Colorado was a couple years later in 2000. There are 15 states and the District of Columbia that have medical marijuana laws. In terms of how all of this relates to MS, it's, like I say, really quite a fascinating story. The science behind this is really didn't get much press, but back in the 1990s, it was identified that there were very specific proteins that marijuana molecules bind to in the brain and in the immune system. And these proteins in the brain, it was found that when the marijuana chemicals bind to them, they tend to tone down excessive nerve cell activity. So for something like pain or muscle stiffness, where there might be excessive nerve cell activity, you could imagine how marijuana might, in theory, provide benefit. Also, the proteins that marijuana binds to on immune cells tend to mildly suppress the immune system. So, in theory, that could actually be good for the underlying disease process of MS. So, the sort of the scientific basis is intriguing for a connection to MS. And then once again, at this point, I'll let you know that we'll be doing questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have questions coming up in your head, make sure you note those. So I just mentioned the sort of the pure science behind marijuana and how it might have applications to MS. We do have an animal model of MS. It's called EAE. It's by no means a perfect model, but it's where we often do early drug testing. And in that animal model, marijuana-like chemicals can help animals with the symptoms from this MS-like disease they get, and that marijuana chemicals might actually slow down the disease course. So like the basic science, the animal model studies are suggestive for beneficial effects. In terms of clinical studies in people, that's where the links get weak, and those are actually very involved and very expensive studies. So over the past 10 to 20 years, there have been smaller studies with marijuana in people with MS suggesting some beneficial effects, especially on pain, spasticity, or muscle stiffness, sleeping difficulty. But like I say, they've been mostly smaller studies, not highly rigorous studies. In the United Kingdom, several years ago, they did the best, highest quality study of marijuana in people with MS, and what they found was that there might be a beneficial effect on muscle stiffness, might also be a beneficial effect in terms of slowing down the disease course. So that study in the United Kingdom led them to develop a further study there. So it's called the CUPID study, C-U-P-I-D, and that's been going on for a few years at this point. And that's people with progressive forms of MS who are being treated with marijuana chemicals to see if it can help with the symptoms of MS and also slow down the disease process. So that's really the really high-quality, rigorous studies are coming out of these United Kingdom studies. And the data from the study I just mentioned, I think that's going to be available toward the end of 2011 or early 2012. So that's all sort of the potential benefits. The concerns with marijuana are ones that might be obvious, like sedation, maybe some impaired driving, decreased coordination. Certainly marijuana smoke has all or more cancer-causing chemicals in it than as tobacco smoke. So there are some concerns with side effects, and there are areas of research to try to find safer ways to administer it. I do think it's important, I think, with the medical marijuana laws in most states, I think MS is listed as a reason for people to get certified so that they can get the medical marijuana. I do think it's important for people to understand that even if it is made legal for MS, that does not mean that we have definitive evidence that it's safe and effective for people with MS. It's more that we have suggestive studies that are suggestive enough that that's how it's actually ended up being approved for medical use. So I think I'll stop there. Once again, the website I mentioned, neurologycare.net, huge amount of information. There are also books that I've written that have chapters on marijuana. That's on that website as well. Also the fall 2010 issue, so the issue that's out now of Momentum has an article that I've written on marijuana, so it goes through all of this in detail. NationalMSSociety.org has other information, and I think the National MS Society is actually sponsoring some marijuana research in the United Kingdom and also a study going on in California. So why don't we stop at that at this point, and any questions you might have on marijuana and MS.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you have any questions, please press the number one key now. One moment while questions come into queue. We currently have two questions in queue, and our first question comes from Renee. Renee, please go ahead.
Yeah. Now, I'm currently not on any kind of MS medication right now. And So is what you're saying, like, marijuana is a good substitute for the meds?
No, I would definitely not say that. I would say that we have some suggestive evidence where it might slow down the disease process, like the FDA-approved drugs for MS, but that's sort of might, and there's suggestive evidence. So that's certainly not definitive, so I would not suggest using marijuana instead of the FDA-approved medications. And if anyone's using medical marijuana for MS, I think you really can't, until we have more information, I would think of it more in terms of trying to relieve symptoms, for example, muscle stiffness or pain or sleep issues, as opposed to thinking of it as having any kind of definitive effect on the underlying disease process. So I would encourage you actually to strongly encourage you to think about a conventional medicine to slow down the disease, and then these other things that we're talking about, I would think more in terms of their complementary use, using them along with the conventional medicines.
Our next question comes from Linda. Linda, please go ahead.
My question has to do with how is the marijuana taken? Do you have to smoke it, or is there a pill, a powder, or something like that? And then also you mentioned having to do with sleep issues. I have sleep apnea, and I'm just wondering if it might help that as well.
So in terms of how it's taken, certainly the most common way people take it now is by smoking, but like I mentioned, there are concerns about, there definitely are lots of cancer-causing chemicals in the smoke, so it raises all the same concerns about tobacco smoking. Other ways that it can be taken, certainly there are ways that people can cook with it, and then there are extracts, so you can actually use an oil to extract out the active chemicals, and then you can take capsules of that oil, and that's really how a lot of the research is being done now. A lot of the formal research studies are trying to give the marijuana in ways that won't expose people to smoke. I would not think, I don't know of any specific studies, but I would not think of marijuana as being helpful for sleep apnea. It's more for, in terms of sleep problems, people having difficulty sleeping, or people having muscle stiffness that interferes with their sleep. And that's certainly, in terms of my anecdotal experience, just sort of what I see in my clinical practice, where people seem to have the greatest benefit is with marijuana, is when they have muscle stiffness that interferes with sleep, and it may be that the marijuana is sedating and it also tends to relax the muscles. So it might be with one drug approach, you can actually help two different symptoms that might feed in a good way off each other.
Our next question comes from Eileen. Eileen, please go ahead.
I used to use the medical marijuana, and by taking just one puff, my symptoms were completely gone, but I moved to another state where it's not legal. But I was wondering if the oral THC had the same effects as smoking.
Yeah, that's a great question, and there have been concerns with that. So the two different factors for smoking versus taking it orally. One is when you take it orally, it goes from the intestines and it immediately goes to the liver, and the liver can potentially inactivate some of the potentially active therapeutic chemicals. So that's one difference for the oral versus the smoked form. And then also, you know, the oral form, if that's an oil extract, it may indeed have most of the chemicals you'd have in the smoked form, but some of the oral forms, especially the prescription forms, really just have THC. And in general, these are more casual studies, but in people with MS who have a benefit with the smoked marijuana, they tend to have less of a benefit with the THC that's given as a prescription form. And it may be, and that presumably is because the marijuana itself has THC plus multiple other chemicals that have beneficial effects as well.
Our next question comes from Marcella. Marcella, please go ahead.
Thank you. Is there any kind of side effects from the oral as far as, you know, liver problems or kidney problems or anything like that you know of?
I don't know of any specific liver or kidney problems, but certainly some of the other side effects that I mentioned can be a factor: sedation, psychiatric issues, cognitive issues, impaired driving, incoordination. So those, but nothing, no other organs of the body seem vulnerable with the oral versus the smoked. So why don't we stop at that point and let's get on to the third category. So these first two are sort of cutting edge, these quintessential topics where there are, you know, literally hundreds of articles written per year. So now we'll kind of step back a few thousand years and go to some really ancient healing methods. So I want to talk about traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda. And I think sometimes people hear about these, know that they were developed, you know, thousands of years ago, and wonder, you know, with all the advances we've made in modern medicine, all the high-tech approaches we have to understand disease and treat disease, can there possibly be anything to learn from healing methods that were developed 2,000 or more years ago? And I think there can be a lot that we can learn. So I'll try to highlight that in what I mentioned tonight. So I'll treat these topics separately. So one of the ancient methods is traditional Chinese medicine. The other is Ayurveda. In terms of traditional Chinese medicine, it was developed in China more than 2,000 years ago. A core concept with traditional Chinese medicine that there's some type of energy that flows through the body and to try to address general health and also treat disease. There are many different approaches that are part of this whole healing method of traditional Chinese medicine. So the healing approaches include things like acupuncture, massage, meditation, tai chi, nutrition approaches, herbal medicine. And if you kind of look at the data for these approaches, some of them may provide some therapeutic effects, even though they were, you know, developed thousands of years ago. So in terms of symptoms that have potential relevance to MS, you know, acupuncture might help with pain, may help with mood issues like anxiety and depression. There's some limited evidence it might help with bladder difficulties, might help with sleep difficulties. So many potential benefits there, and that's a very low-risk approach. And then also massage, that's a component of traditional Chinese medicine. That may help with anxiety, depression, and pain. Meditation may help with anxiety, depression, and pain as well. And then Tai Chi is quite interesting in that it, I think many people can kind of remember the first time they saw someone doing Tai Chi, and it just looks very different than Western exercise. And a lot of what we think about when we think of Western exercise, it's sort of sending signals from the brain out to the muscles, and that leads to, you know, activation of the muscles, can lead to increased strength. But that's really only part of the nervous system. There's a whole other part of the nervous system going from the arms and legs up to the brain. So that's sort of the sensation part of the nervous system. And we often don't exercise that very much with Western exercise. And in people with MS, and especially people early on with MS, the main neurological issue they may have is actually with their balance, which is connected with the sensation part of the nervous system. So approaches like Tai Chi really are good ways to activate the pathways from the brain down to the muscle to hold the postures, but then part of holding the postures is having a good sense of balance. So that aspect of Tai Chi can exercise the nerve pathways going from the arms and legs back up to the brain. So there might be some wisdom in those the ancient exercises that maybe is sometimes missing from our current Western approach to exercise. It's important to also keep in mind, I just mentioned some potential benefits of traditional Chinese medicine, but there are some potential risks as well. And those come mainly with the Chinese herbal medicine. And Chinese herbal medicine may sometimes be given kind of casually at the end of an acupuncture session, might get a baggie with some herbs in it, and to use those until you come back for the next acupuncture session. The concern there is that there are many herbs used in traditional Chinese medicine which may potentially activate the immune system. There are actually more than or nearly 20 different herbs used in traditional Chinese medicine that are potentially immune-stimulating. There also are some Chinese herbs that have potential significant toxicity, like there's something known as thunder god vine, ma wang, which may still be used within traditional Chinese medicine, may have significant toxicity as well. So it's kind of a confusing picture where within this single healing method, you have things that are very low risk and may provide benefit for multiple symptoms like acupuncture and massage and meditation. But then all within the same healing system, there are these herbs that for people with MS specifically might pose significant risks. So I'll give you a reminder again that we have a question and answer time coming up in about 5 minutes here. So that's what I wanted to say about traditional Chinese medicine. Now move on to Ayurveda, which is actually older than traditional Chinese medicine. Ayurveda originated in India, like traditional Chinese medicine. Within Ayurveda, there's a thought that there's some energy that travels through the body. And also, like traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda has multiple diverse treatment approaches. So as with traditional Chinese medicine, massage, meditation, nutrition approaches may be an element. Also, yoga was developed through Ayurvedic methods. In terms of how these different Ayurvedic treatment methods might help or might affect people with MS, there actually was a very high-quality study done with yoga in people with MS, and that in that study they treated people with yoga, they treated them with conventional exercise, and then there was a group that they didn't treat at all. And what was found was that conventional exercise or yoga, either one was quite helpful for MS-related fatigue. And that was quite a well-done study done at Oregon Health Sciences University. Also within Ayurveda, there are these other healing methods like massage and meditation, and I mentioned those before in reference to traditional Chinese medicine. And specifically, massage and meditation might help with symptoms like anxiety, depression, and pain. As with traditional Chinese medicine, you know, there are some factors that need to be taken account in terms of safety with Ayurveda. And the one that I see as greatest concern is one of the supplements used within Ayurveda. It's known as ashwagandha. And somehow in the literature on Ayurveda and MS, recommendations were made without any evidence that people with MS can benefit by taking ashwagandha. The concern is that if you look, you don't have to look too hard in the scientific literature to see that ashwagandha actually activates the immune system. There are multiple studies showing that, and pretty general information on ashwagandha says that people with immune diseases should not take it, and also people taking medications that affect the immune system should not take it because it might negate the beneficial effects of the medication. So I would be cautious about that specific supplement. But I think the message with Ayurveda overall is kind of like the message with traditional Chinese medicine, that a lot of the sort of multimodal treatment approaches that might be quite a rich approach and there might be lots of potential benefits for people with MS, but I think for both healing methods, you need to be cautious about the herbs or supplements that are recommended. For both healing methods, there's no good evidence that any of the supplements or herbs provide benefits, and there are theoretical risks with quite a few of the herbs in traditional Chinese medicine and ashwagandha specifically within Ayurveda. And it does make you wonder, maybe we can take some of the good from the past and mix it with some of the good from the present. And what I mean by that is to try to identify good things that we can get out of using multiple treatment approaches like these ancient healing methods. But maybe some of the ancient healing methods aren't so good, at least at this point by our understanding. Maybe the sort of more molecular approaches using supplements or herbs in these ancient healing methods, we really don't know about the safety, and maybe there are some safety issues there, and maybe we can sort of take those out of the equation and put in all the great developments we've had in Western medicine to use those molecular approaches and blend them in with some of the more ancient non-molecular approaches like acupuncture and yoga and massage and meditation. So those are my general thoughts in that those areas, and I think there can be a lot of richness, and I think that's an area that can be quite rewarding for people with MS to explore. There's a lot of information on my website and the books I've written. I think two issues ago in Momentum, you can just search on nationalmssociety.org. I think it was the summer of 2010 issue of Momentum. There's a whole article that I wrote on that. There's other information on the National MS Society website as well. So why don't we stop at that point and open it up for questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you have any questions, please press the number one key now. We currently have three questions in queue, and our first question comes from Julie. Julie, please go ahead.
Hello, thank you. My question is, where would be a good source to find out the exact names of the TCM herbs that you mentioned activate the immune system? And could you explain what you mean by activating the immune system? Do you mean it increases production of autoantibodies, or what specifically do you mean by that?
Yeah, what most of those herbs do is they activate one or both of some specific immune cells. So T cells, that's a specific type of immune cell known as a lymphocyte that's already excessively active in MS. So these herbs activate the T cells. And then also macrophages, which can be excessively active in MS, can be activated by the herbs as well. So a few places that you can go. There's a fairly detailed list just on the information on my website, so you can just go to the alternative medicine information, and this is at neurologycare.net. You can just go to alternative medicine information, and then there's a chapter on acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine. So some of the more common herbs are listed there, like 5 or 10 of them, and then a very detailed listing is in a book, and there's actually a whole table in the book of the herbs to be cautious about, and that's the book is Complementary and Alternative Medicine and MS, and that's on, you can see that on the website. It's available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Most bookstores have access to it. But there's a table in there with Chinese herbs that can specifically activate the immune system, and then Chinese herbs sometimes used for MS that might have specific side effects to be aware of.
Our next question comes from Renee. Renee, please go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned that the acupuncture, meditation, the massage and everything, you know, that helps with the pain.
Uh-huh. Right.
Why is every doctor I've been to is not willing to associate pain with the MS, but everybody I know that has MS has pain and didn't before? And,
right.
Oh, and I don't know if I can, like, there's another one, too.
Sure.
Another question. And does any of them help with concentration, your attention span, things like that?
Right. So in terms of pain, you know, if you look at the older textbooks of MS, on MS or general neurology textbooks, they say the pain does not happen in MS, but that sort of perplexed MS clinicians a long time ago, because we had these textbooks on our shelves that said people with MS don't have pain, but then all, you know, very busy MS clinics, we see people all day, and, you know, a significant percent had all kinds of different pain syndromes. So there was sort of a mismatch between what was in the textbook and what we were actually seeing in practice. So that mismatch generally got corrected, I'd say about 10 years ago, 10 to 15 years ago, where follow-up studies were done, and it was found that about 50% of people with MS can have some kind of pain. There are lots of different types of pain syndromes that people with MS are vulnerable to. For example, migraines and other headaches, or people with MS are at a higher risk for those. There can be neck pain, low back pain, nerve-specific pain, a specific type of facial pain. So there are lots of different pain types that can occur with MS, and the first step is to identify what specific type of MS pain it is, and then there are lots of different treatment approaches that can potentially be used. In terms of concentration and attention difficulties, you know, MS can affect cognitive processes, like as with pain, it's probably about 50% of people with MS can have some kind of cognitive difficulty. For many of those people, for the majority of those people, it's quite mild. It may not be a huge issue, but on really formal testing might be able to identify that. In terms of how to address that, first thing is to make sure there aren't other medical issues that might be contributing to it, like medication side effects. Make sure that's not a factor. Make sure there aren't any mood issues like depression that can produce cognitive problems. Other medical issues could cause cognitive problems. So you really need to, as with the pain, identify what the underlying cause is for the cognitive difficulty. If it's MS-specific cognitive difficulty, there's some studies with variable results, but some drugs used for Alzheimer's disease might provide some beneficial effects. There's some limited evidence that regular physical activity in people with MS might actually improve cognitive function. And then some growing line of research that sort of like you do physical activity, you know, doing regular cognitive activity might produce some benefits. And so there are various ways you can try to do the cognitive exercises. I think one of the nice programs that's out there is actually a service through the National MS Society, where they partnered with Microsoft to try to come up with ways to use technology to help people with MS, and one of the first things they came up with were software games for trying to develop cognitive abilities. So you can access that through a website, mymsmyway.com. I'll say that again. It's kind of it sounds easy, but when you start writing it down, there are lots of M's in there, but it's mymsmyway.com, and then you can go to My Brain Games. And that's a way to sort of get an introduction and see if that's something that might be appealing to you. And then there are other places you can go to get some very sophisticated cognitive exercises. Any other questions?
We do have one more question.
Uh-huh.
Our last question comes from Teresa. Teresa, please go ahead.
Yes. I have been using naturopathic healing for at least 5 years. I'm considered a quadriplegic, but I scratch my face, and once in a while I stand up on my own, which is amazing. I have a friend from Thailand, and she's a nurse. Her and her sister, who is also a nurse, and a pharmacist in Thailand, studied the red mushroom system. It's for immune system disorders in Thailand. They'd never heard of MS, so they studied it. They spent a long time studying it, and I used it for a year. What I noticed is my headaches were gone, my pain was gone, and I remained much stronger. So my experience has been naturopathic is the only way to go. I will walk again.
Great. I like your hope and your positive approach there. And, yeah, I think if you sort of experiment with things, I think it's important to have an understanding of what you're using. And, you know, I do think there are lots of approaches that might be unconventional that I think can be sort of put to the test and studied, and especially studied specifically in MS to see if they're safe and see if they're effective. And that's certainly a direction for the future. I think National MS Society is putting significant funding into research in that area. Also, I do think even though we have incomplete understanding of some of these approaches, I think there are ways to sort of take the best of what's out there at this point in terms of safety and effectiveness. And you can, I think, sort of take the best of what's there, and you can wisely mix that with the conventional approaches. And for some people, that might be the best overall approach to manage the disease. So why don't we end at that point? And I want to thank everyone for attending the program and for some excellent questions, and a pleasure on my part to be able to share what I know in this area. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bowling, and thank you, everybody, for joining our call this evening. Have a great night.